Hi there, and welcome to the Women's Room Legal Division podcast. Here you'll find conversations with fabulous women working in the law about their careers, challenges they've faced, as well as some live coaching around a specific issue. You'll also find some sessions with me alone, dealing with topics that come up regularly when I coach that I hope you'll find helpful. Enjoy this episode. So today I'm delighted to be joined by Stephanie Pagny, who is currently General Counsel of Monzo. I would describe Stephanie as a real force of nature, fiercely committed to doing the right thing and ensuring that the organisations she works for do the same, but never losing her feminine touch, her humanity or her humour. I see her as a real role model for women working in the law, and I think this will be a great conversation. So Stephanie, you've had a really interesting and varied career. Could I just ask you to maybe tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, sure. And thank you for that lovely introduction, Erica. And I have the same regard for you, as you know, having worked together for a long time, over a number of years previously. So I've been working in law for over 30 years, showing my age now. Funnily enough, my first job, I studied law at university. I did a master's in law, but then I didn't go on to become immediately qualified. I actually went to work in a small derivatives house, Sumitomo Bank Capital Markets. I wanted to get some industry experience first before qualifying. And at the time, I didn't think perhaps it seemed like not a very logical linear path to follow. But actually, in hindsight, it turned out to be a really, really valuable thing to do. So I learned a lot about being on a trading floor. I worked at the side of a trading desk, sort of undertaking all the documentation and so forth. But eventually I left there. I spent a couple of years there. I worked for UBS after that. Then I went to Credit Suisse, where I met one of my best friends today, and also the godmother to my son. And we, from that point, she was also a paralegal, and we persuaded the then general counsel to adopt training contracts for lawyers. Actually, they were one of the first Credit Suisse. Financial Products was one of the first banks in the city to run training contracts for lawyers. At that point, of course, I was just a derivatives paralegal and then capital markets paralegal. And then I left as part of my training contract to work with Allen & Overy as a trainee, where they encouraged me to stay on as a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And I pivoted after that and became a litigator. So I moved into a very different field, which I found absolutely fascinating, particularly the psychology of litigation. It sort of calls on all your skills as a lawyer, really, across a whole range of areas. I worked for Allen & Overy for a few years, and I left Allen & Overy as a senior associate, and I went to work for Barclays. As you know, that's how we met. Mm-hmm. I spent 15 years at Barclays, primarily managing all the litigation enforcement matters, crisis management, and so forth. And then I moved over while I was at Barclays to become the general counsel of the retail bank, where I met Ashok Vaswani, an amazing sort of visionary leader in very, very much in the sort of fintech sector. And then finally, I obviously jumped ship and went to Monzo. This is a sort of very heavily mission-driven company, which is where I've been today. And I've been there for the last 3 years. So it's been quite a journey.
Yeah.
Only linear path.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a great example, because obviously nowadays careers aren't as linear and they're not just going up in this sort of upward trajectory. So you've done many, many things. And also you're in this incredible position and you started life as a paralegal, which a lot of people are having to do nowadays. So it shows you what you can achieve.
I think it's really important that we talk about that with careers. When I talk to younger lawyers or even people that aren't lawyers yet, to demystify things, because sometimes you forget when you've been in somewhere so long and people look up and they think, oh, you know, how do I get to that lofty height? And of course, it's always much more complicated than it looks. It's never been as seamless as it looks. Mm. I talk of it as sort of almost like there's no sort of single path up. It's like lots of different mountains, and you might sort of climb one and then you find that actually you have to almost go back down again to join a different mountain, do something slightly different. And that is actually the definition of stretching and learning your career anyway. If you're not doing that, you're probably not stretching yourself and learning and feeling a little bit outside of your comfort zone, which I'm sure we'll come on to talk about, because that's actually an important part of personal growth.
Yeah, definitely. And then tell us a little bit about home life, because I think it's interesting for people to hear about, you know, you've had this amazing career. Like, have you been able to focus 100% of your time on career, or what's going on at home?
Well, it's like a constant juggling, isn't it? Well, I always said, when I had my son when I was at Allen & Overy as a junior associate, and I can remember feeling utterly panicked by this idea that I was going to have my son so early in my career. But actually, there was never some wise words were spoken to me about a couple of partners there saying this, you know, that's not the way to think about it. Obviously, there's never a right time if you're going to think about it in that respect.
Yeah.
I actually partly regret going back so soon after, I think, parental leave today. I would have taken more at that point in time because it goes so fast. You don't, if somebody could tell you that at that point in time, how quickly it goes and how quickly your children grow up, you probably would make a slightly different decision, I think, because career should be there.
How long did you take?
For 4 months, three months. Yeah, 3 or 4 months, which is not very long.
Yeah.
The standards, I would say. But I just felt that I should get back and so forth. I don't think it had any bearing on my career whatsoever, by the way,
mm-hmm.
if it had been longer or shorter. So, but and of course, it's just a constant juggling act, as it always is when you've got home demands. You know that my son was sick for a long time. When he got 15, he developed an autoimmune illness. So I'm constantly having to balance. But I've always taken the view that it's really quality that matters, the quality of time you're spending. And obviously, you know, a happy mother also makes her a happy child. You know, you also mm-hmm. need to, oh, don't you have your own life and interests? And I think it's also good role modeling. I know from speaking to my children, my stepchildren as well, that it's important that they've grown up, and my son's grown up in particular, with a very gender neutral view of roles in the world. You know, there's no role that he sees as defined as whether you're, you know, whatever gender you are, holding that role. And I think if you asked him, he would say he's proud that his mum worked mm-hmm. a lawyer. And would I choose to be a lawyer today? I don't know. I often get asked that. And I think sometimes probably would have become a biochemist. I'm absolutely fascinated with going on in science right now, particularly sort of biotechnology and the whole kind of fusing of synthetic biology. Mm-hmm. I just think it's so fascinating. And I nearly went down that path when I was 18. I nearly studied chemistry and went in a completely different direction. So maybe I would do that today.
There's still time, Stephanie. There's still time. Yeah, it's interesting because I think I'd now love to be a neuroscientist. And I thought about doing psychiatry when I was 18, but was really bad at chemistry. So the sort of medical route was sort of out. Let me pivot slightly and let's just talk about coaching. So have you ever had coaching during your career?
I have. I've had quite a lot of coaching, actually, but maybe not as much as some. But I certainly have had coaches at different parts of my career. I was thinking back, actually, in anticipation of this chat, when that first point happened, when that first intervention happened, I think it was actually quite a long time ago. When I was at Barclays, it certainly didn't happen whilst I was at the law firm. And as you know, I think law firms have got better in this regard today, but historically they haven't been brilliant at focusing on developing soft skills, leadership capability. It's not something that lawyers historically are trained to focus on, which is why I think it is incredibly important, obviously, to help lawyers develop leadership capability, because they have to become leaders of their own teams and their own businesses ultimately. But that was my first coaching intervention. I think when I was at Barclays around 2007, 2008. And that was firstly about really, very much focused on leadership, developing mm-hmm. leadership abilities, thinking about leading through others, rather than just doing the work yourself
mm-hmm.
and helping you to adapt to the idea of sort of, you know, coach, player coach, not just player, and sort of stepping back. And because lawyers, there's a tendency to, obviously, you're trained as an expert, you want to have the answers to everything, and you're there to provide great legal advice. And then this idea that you sort of step away from that almost and you start leading through others is actually quite a new skill that you have mm-hmm. to acquire. So having somebody talk to you about the different strategies and ways of doing that, it was incredibly helpful.
Good. Okay. So that was a really helpful coaching intervention. I think the law firms are changing, but there is still a bit of a tendency to regard coaching as, you know, when there's an issue or a challenge or a problem, rather than using your highest performers to just make mm-hmm. them even stronger. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I think that's a really important point, not just to see it as on the downside, mm-hmm. as an enabler, an unlocker of potential, because it makes you step back. Because the other thing I found with it was, and I remember going to some sessions thinking, this is so indulgent, you know, mm-hmm. I've got advice to write and things to get on with. But actually just taking the time, recognizing that it is time well invested in thinking about talking stuff through and talking about like the challenges of the day. And if you're moving into a more senior leadership role and you are engaging more people, and perhaps we'll talk a little bit as well about that big transition between from what I call managing local teams to scale leadership
mm-hmm.
and leading very large teams. That is a very different skill set mm-hmm. that most people don't naturally acquire, that you need to be able to talk to somebody about what their tried and tested strategies are for that, and how are you going to change the way you actually interact with people? How are you going to change the way you think about how you carve your time up, for example, in terms of effective time management? How much value you should be ascribing to those leadership moments, because that's actually how you become really effective in leading, you know, a team of people, a wide team of people, versus just delivering yourself the work and so forth. And I personally found it extremely helpful, you know, going through those sort of sessions.
So how do you, can I ask, because we're coming up to like the end of the year, and it's interesting, I've just recorded a video about like how to do goal setting for the year ahead, but do you take time out now to sit back and think strategically? How do you get that more time, you know, that strategic input? How do you do that nowadays?
So I mean, it's difficult, number one, because particularly when you're so busy in the week and there's just so much stuff to do and keep on top of. But one of the things I say to my team, so on a regular basis, well, we're actually quite fortunate at Mondo in that we try to keep some section of Fridays free of meetings. It doesn't always work out that way, but it's actually quite a good discipline, because I sort of label it with my team. Think of it as your capital investment time. If the rest of the time you're just running business and helping to ensure things are moving forward and you're unlocking problems and so forth, but think about that time as take a step back. You know, and lots of other companies like Google and others call it the blue sky thinking moment, but just really take a step back, sort of switch off the emails for a bit and think about, right, what do I need to think about from a kind of team structuring standpoint, or the people's development needs, or how do I think about setting things up right? And that can sometimes you can't really afford to leave that till the end of the year, but it's a good checkpoint, obviously, when things go a bit quieter, to take that time. Mm-hmm. And what I'm doing, funnily enough, this Friday, I've got a whole day set aside to focus on exactly that, to think about future organizational design. You know, where's the organization going? How's it growing? How do we meet those growing needs? How are we going to meet them through different strategies, not just people strategies, but process changes and so forth? And that is the core component of being a leader, and the bit that, you know, doesn't come to you naturally. You know, yeah. These are, you learn through some of these coaching interventions, because coaches can bring to bear all the strategies that other leaders have deployed successfully, obviously without reaching any confidences. And I guess it's not all going to be in your own head. You know, you're not going to have known it all from experience. And that's, I think, one of the most valuable things about coaching.
Brilliant. And then you mentioned this transition into scale leadership. Can you talk a bit more about that? And what is it you think people need to do from managing sort of more local teams to really taking it up to scale leadership?
Yeah, so there's some practical things. Like, so for example, one of the wonderful things about having a very small team is that it can feel very intimate. Even the more senior leaders in the team can spend a lot of time with every member of the team, regardless of, you know, of their level of experience and so forth. But if you think about that from a practical standpoint, as the team starts to grow, not only does that become more and more difficult, because imagine if you were spending all of your time in one-to-ones with every single team member every week, you would then have no time to actually get on with some of the other work and actually mm-hmm. deliver some of the core outputs. But also you also run the risk as the team grows and gets bigger and bigger of unintentionally creating groups of, because somebody might demand more of your time, spending time with more people than other people, it looks a bit exclusive, rather than creating an accessible, a consistently accessible platform to leadership. So one of the tools I've deployed when that started to happen is, you know, having leadership lunches where with specific cohorts in the wider team. So you take a cohort of directors or VPs or whatever level people are, and you have leadership lunches with them once a month or once every other month. And you coalesce around a specific thematic topic, and then you really encourage people to talk about their different career perspectives. Actually, it's really useful. Sometimes you find that group's coming together for the first time as well. Bring them along. We've done this before in the past, bringing mm-hmm. different groups together to connect them. But they then really, you know, they can really benefit from the leadership insights that you can share with them around the table like this. Talk about your career insights, you know, sort of demystify some of it for them, and then you give them, you know, fair, consistent access to that leader in a way that's more consistent and is there, rather than just perhaps spending time. And it would be unintentional that you might end up spending more time with others in the team, and that wouldn't be the right thing to do as you're trying to scale that team. And so there's lots of those kind of practical strategies where you might actually shift gear or sort of change the way that you're thinking about how you engage with your team from local to global. And that goes through, I mean, you yourself have managed very large teams, understanding how you can enable the next tier of leadership effectively, you know, setting out clearly what your expectations are of them, giving them accountability for things, to run with things and deliver things and sort of almost unlock their own leadership capability and potential, spend time, invest time in having ensure they're coached beyond their layer of leadership and so forth, and that you're setting out your expectations and values for the team and so forth, so that that then percolates down throughout the team in terms of expectations and the importance that you put on leadership as well.
And do you think, I mean, one of the things I deal with quite a lot that comes up, you know, time and time again, is delegation. What's your advice when people come to you to say, you know, you feel like they're not delegating enough, they're taking too much on, they're not empowering the people underneath? How do you, what would you advise people to do? How would you approach that?
Well, usually there's a reason that's happening. So it could be a variety of reasons. Sometimes it can be because the leader themselves hasn't been used or is not accustomed to delegating and leading through larger teams, and therefore they're used to being in control of everything and having been in the weeds and everything. So if that's the issue, then you obviously need to tackle that with the leader and help them to change the way they're operating and their daily practices. Sometimes it's because they don't trust the person that they're delegating to, or they lack confidence in their ability to delegate in an effective way. If that's the case, then obviously that needs to be evaluated, and perhaps there isn't a reason not to trust them, but perhaps they need to, you know, find a different way of engaging with each other. So it is a problem that obviously needs to be tackled, because it can be a sort of enormous hindrance to the team being effectively scale. But there could be, you know, there could be a variety of reasons why it's happening. And it's actually usually quite a good idea to understand both perspectives and see what's actually going on, whether there's cause and effect going on. But by and large, I always found, I mean, lawyers like practical strategies as well. So they're like practical, tangible things that you can do differently. So I talk very much in terms of what can you do differently. So, for example, you could say to the individual who's trying but struggling to delegate, find discrete pieces of work that somebody else can do, explain what the parameters are that you're looking for to do, send them off to do it, and ask them to package it up and then bring it back to you so you can know what they're doing. And at each key checkpoint, for example, that will give you a sense of confidence and control still whilst not actually doing the work yourself.
Yeah.
There's also an ability to then test the quality with which the work is being done by the other individual.
Yeah. I mean, it is hard because it is, you know, you're giving away your sort of comfort zone by giving it to someone else. And then you hear a lot, well, I can do it quicker. And I always say, well, look, if you can train them up, you might not have to do it at all, even if at this stage you could do it faster. And I have a little mantra that I can't remember who said it to me, but I think it was someone at Barclays, but it was really powerful, which is only do what only you can do. So that literally you think, am I the only person who can do this, or could someone else do it? Do the things where it's really important that it's you doing it is one of the things I talk to people about. It's just a really useful checkpoint to say that to yourself.
That's a great way of thinking about it, I think. Really great way, because there are very few things that other people can't do at that point. Yeah. And that's best, isn't it? I often say I just could do my job without effective delegation, without really good people under me and delegating effectively. It's my responsibility to find successful routes through to delegating effectively.
Mm-hmm.
Can't. I mean, you know, you can't run a scale. You can't run a large team without effective delegation. You just can't do your job. But
you can. So I was going to ask you about like sort of challenging times you've had or perhaps a topic where you've thought, do you know what, looking back, or even if there's something now, I could have really done with some coaching around that. And maybe we'll just delve into a sort of challenge area in a bit more detail.
Yeah, I think I'm thinking about a time way back at Barclays when I joined when I was sort of relatively junior, but I remember working on a project with individuals and working unbelievably hard, like really long hours, and thinking I was being unbelievably effective and then being up for promotion and just being passed over for that promotion on the basis that I wasn't visible.
Mm-hmm.
It was the biggest surprise to me. And I thought this was a big lesson for me. And as tends to be, I think, for lawyers in general, that sometimes it's not enough to just sit and sort of labor away at the task in hand at your desk. I mean, as it was then at desk, because we didn't really remote work, without sort of, I don't want to put the word out, networking, because it's not really networking. It's more getting out there and engaging and building relationships and building sponsorship. We'll talk about sponsorship, because I used to underrate the significance of sponsorship throughout my career on the basis that you're a brilliant lawyer. Why just get ahead on merit? And of course, empathy in an enormous organization, not everybody, well, really, are you really having the impact you need to have? And this is not a cynical observation. This is the reality of life. Or everything works on the basis also of not just obviously the quality of the work you're producing, but obviously you have to build relationships and rapport with people as well. And obviously as a lawyer, when you're coming from a law firm, that becomes quite critical in-house too. And I'm not talking about building partial relationships. I'm just talking about, you understand the point I'm driving at, which is just really sponsorship and ensuring you're engaging with the right people, that they understand that this is the work you're doing, that this is the impact you're having and you're creating, and that you're sort of putting your head above the parapet, so to speak, which may not come naturally to many lawyers.
Yeah, and particularly not many women. I mean, that comes up a lot, I think. I mean, Sheryl Sandberg called it tiara syndrome, doing an amazing job and waiting in your office for someone to come with the velvet pillow with the tiara on to say, you deserve this because you've been so amazing. But I think people find it really hard to work out, how do I show people how great I'm being without being someone I would despise, like a show off? And we're all, a lot of our upbringings have been like, don't show off, don't put yourself forward, don't. So how have you approached that?
You said, because I remember being a little girl in classroom. I mean, when we grew up as well, girls didn't really put their hand up even. Mm. Some of that is embedded psychology in just like working hard, being quiet, working hard in the corner and getting good marks for your work, but then sort of otherwise not really sort of waving your hand and saying, hey, I'm here. And I'm sure a lot of that is embedded in that. So you have to unlearn that, but in the right way, obviously, don't you? So I would even be, some of the things I did to pivot were, actually, this is one of the most effective ways, I think, of getting yourself noticed in the right way. And I've often shared this with some of my team throughout time, which is to think about a way which you can interact with business stakeholders, where you can invite more than your sort of usual circle of stakeholders to the room. Often for lawyers, it's things like running a training session or doing something which is going to add value to the business and maybe put you in the sphere of interaction with business people who you wouldn't necessarily deal with day to day, for example, and you can have big impact. Now, that does involve some public speaking, of course, which is different. And to some extent, if you're going to be a senior leader, you're going to have to do some of that anyway, because you have to be able to stand up and talk about your area and group. And you don't have to be an extrovert to learn how to do that. We've obviously had separate coaching interventions on that with, in terms of doing the old Vic course and so forth. So do you miss the confidence building that even professionals engage in, professional actors and actresses, and it really helps, I think, doing those sorts of courses. But that will be one of the strategies I recommended and that did work for me, which is to find ways where you can put yourself in front of an audience, talk about your work, or ask for the opportunity. Most line managers or most lead, if you put yourself forward and say, I'd like an opportunity to talk about that, present on that, or talk about and have impact, will allow you to do that, unless they're not a very good line manager who's not really got a good line manager will want to put their line report forward and enable them to have a platform. I certainly would do that for mine, where it's feasible. If somebody's done the work, I will want them to be able to have the opportunity to present on it. I think that's really important to be sort of provide that stage, that platform.
Yeah. So really going out, showing people what you're doing and networking. I mean, in terms of sponsorship, because I think, again, there have been formal sponsorship programs in organizations that don't really work, because sponsorship isn't something you can sort of parcel out. No. So how do you go about getting sponsorship from people?
So again, I think it's difficult, isn't it? There's obviously, as you say, networking events, bringing people together generally with common interests, and that can help, obviously, creating senior leadership forums and so forth, and getting people to know people, because that wouldn't otherwise meet and get to know each other. I think that is really important in less formal things. But there is nothing that beats, looking for the next big opportunity, piece of work where you can create impact. And with that comes higher risk, because generally speaking, you're probably going to be taking a bit more of a risk in taking on a piece of work or a project, which requires a higher degree of autonomy, and for you to be able to show that you can lead that piece of work. So people need to be prepared to sort of feel uncomfortable, I think, and then have an opportunity to, most of that true sponsorship, as you know, comes with working with people. And then building trust and building respect for the you know, your work ethic and the product you're delivering and the support you're providing them. My sponsorship has all come from that sort of true interaction, level of interaction where you develop a genuine professional respect for each other and kind of like working ethos and so forth. So I think there aren't many shortcuts to it in reality. Yes.
I mean, like,
you have to look for the opportunity though. You can't expect somebody to deliver it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it does mean pushing out of your comfort zone. I mean, it's interesting. The thing about girls and not putting themselves forward. There's a book by Marianne Seacart called The Authority Gap, which is a great book. I mean, it made me quite angry when I first listened to it, because we're still doing a lot to make girls feel different. And even teachers are still, if they're putting out a question and no one answers, they will still call on the boys because they don't want to embarrass the girl. They're worried about embarrassing the girls or upsetting the girls. And so the boys get called on more. So they get used to not knowing the answer, maybe having to make it up, maybe a bit of bullshitting. And she says, it looks like we're building confidence factories for the boys and competence factories for the girls, where they get by on being really good at what they do. So it was, and I spoke to my son's fiance is a primary school teacher, and I said this to her, and she was like, oh my God, that is what I do. So it's so interesting. We're trying to protect people, but actually we're not doing them any favors. I mean, I would say on sponsorship as well, I talk sometimes about a personal board of directors and having people you can go to for advice. So I would say to people, like, if you see someone that you admire in an organization, or you come across them and you'd just like to hear a bit of their advice or, you know, their lessons from life, go and, you know, ask them, because people actually are really generous with their time and they quite like talking about themselves. What you don't want to do is send an email saying, could you be my sponsor? And can I meet you once a week for an hour and a half for you to, you know, to sponsor me? But you could form a relationship by just following up with someone. It feels scary because you're putting yourself out there. But again, just say, what's the worst that can happen? The worst that can happen is they could say, no, I'm really sorry, I'm too busy at the moment. And sometimes I would do that if people contacted me, but I'd usually say, I'm really busy, but here's someone else I think you should go and talk to who'd be a great resource. So that sort of always going out and asking people for their advice is, you know, it can be really helpful.
It's good advice. And actually on that, because I've always felt a bit sort of more, you know, I should be self-sufficient or I don't want to bother that person. Or First of all, I've not had like any fixed mentors in my life, but I've certainly had people from whom I have learned. Mm-hmm. Who've been quasi mentors, where I've always thought, oh, I like the way that they do that, or and take the best of the way you see somebody interact will be really effective, and maybe also learn about how not to do things as well in that context. And that's also really important. But whenever I have asked, even the two or three people I've asked, they've always been unbelievably generous, you know, with their time and, as you say, and have just wanted to help and wanted to provide the benefit of their career insights and experience and so forth. So I think that's a really important point. But you do have to take, as you say, responsibility for working out who that board of directors should be, or those few mentors that are going to pass through your career and your life. And it is a gender neutral thing as well. Like, if it's been men and women, you know, depending on particular circumstances, and, you know, there may be a specific style that you think that person's got this amazing style and they're unbelievably effective, but understated, which tends to be the style I gravitate towards anyway. You know, how do they do that? And to sort of unpick it a little bit with it's a really good piece of advice.
And I guess an adjunct of like making yourself more visible, making the work that you're doing more visible, a sort of part of that is then coming to ask for more money and more compensation, which is obviously quite topical at the moment, this time of year.
So difficult to do.
Yeah. Okay. So have you found that hard to do?
Very. Mm-hmm. Yes. Very. I think you always think of it in terms of, you know, so first of all, I think partly what drives your value system. And I'm not suggesting that women don't want to be well paid, but generally speaking, and it's certainly the case for me, you'll find that I need to feel rewarded in other right ways. So I need to feel that the work I'm doing is meaningful, that it's moving things forward, that it's constructive, that it's positive, in a positive learning environment, that I'm learning still, that I feel like I'm growing and so forth. So that's almost like your first principle. And so, of course, as an adjunct to that, you want to make sure that you're being paid your market value and so forth. But all the conversations I've ever had about it have been anchored in that kind of terminology, because it is such a difficult topic for women to raise, I think, almost without exception. I mean, maybe some, but certainly in my experience, and all the conversations I've ever had in my career where people have demanded more money have always started by, they just find it's much easier. I don't know why that is, but just put it straight out there. But it is an important conversation to have, because if nothing else, well, every organization has an interest today in making sure in sort of gender parity when it comes to pay and so forth. So, but it would be good to have, I think, for women to have tools to help equip them to have those conversations in a way that's not, that's perceived as perfectly fair, you know, perfectly reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not you're asking for something unreasonable.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because we think, if I say to people like, who say, I don't want to ask for, you know, I feel really uncomfortable, I'm like, what's the worst that could happen? Which is often a really good coaching question. So the worst that could happen is they could say no. And sometimes people have said to me, that makes me then question, oh, maybe I'm not good enough. It sends them into a spiral of that no means there's something wrong with me because I've asked for the thing and I haven't been given it. Sometimes it's because they're worried about how the person's going to view them. So they're going to think I'm really pushy and how dare I? Who do I think I am? So then we'll go through like, well, so how likely is it for them to think that? What would you think if someone came to you in the same situation? And generally they just think, okay, no, that's impressive. I wish I could be more like that. And what are they more likely to think? If they, even if they did think you were really pushy, is it going to really impact negatively on your career? Or is it just going to mean they're going to pay a bit more attention when they're doing your compensation? So what I often do is I say to people, let's write down what you would say. Maybe let's write an email about what you would say and let's see what that feels like and tell them why you're worth it. Tell them what's valuable about you. And often when people have done that exercise, they feel much more comfortable going and saying, you know, this is why I'm worth it. This is why I'm asking for this. Do it in a really reasonable way. Try not to get emotional about it and accept if the no comes, it doesn't matter. Like you asked, the great thing is you asked and the no means nothing because you don't know what's going on behind the scenes. You don't know how the company's really doing. There could be many, many reasons why they say no. And it won't be that they think you're rubbish and therefore they're saying no. Very unlikely to be that.
Well, it's totally fair. And actually, I'm now thinking in the past, back past when I've had those conversations, I've always equipped myself, first of all, with benchmarking data.
Mm-hmm.
As well, yeah. As a way to go in with a scientific basis for the request, number one.
Yeah.
And that's not that difficult to get. Obviously, you need to know roughly, you should know roughly what your worth is anyway. And women typically haven't been very good at doing that. So that's one thing I would say is just finding tools and ways in which you can actually get the information, number one, mm-hmm. understand where you bench on that in terms of where the company is, in terms of the you know, the gradient at which it aspires to pay or others in your similar roles are being paid and so forth. That if that's your starting point, nobody can ever say that's an unreasonable conversation to have. And then, of course, say it ends up being no, it's important just to understand why. It will most certainly be not because you've not made reasonable arguments, but perhaps because, as you say, that year the company's having a particularly difficult time and you know, or nobody's going to be getting, you know, the rise that they want and so forth. There'll be other reasons and there's nothing wrong with unpicking them, but it's unlikely to be personal to the individual.
Yeah.
It's just that women may have a tendency to feel that it is, which may deter them from having the conversation in the first place. I've always found it easier just to say, well, what's the objective criteria that we're actually discussing here? It's not about me personally. It's about somebody else in this role with these capabilities, with this level of experience is being paid X, you know, and that way almost always to depersonalize it.
Yeah. So before I go on to ask you like your three pieces of advice to your younger self, I just wanted to cover two topics that we've touched on when we've been talking before that I think people would find really interesting. The first one is about lawyers being a bit more outward looking, a bit more business minded. And the second is let's have a talk about the future of what's the future of being a lawyer potentially look like given all the developments in AI and automation. But first of all, your views on being a narrow lawyer, sort of advising on the black letter to, you know, being a more commercial and rounded O-shaped lawyer?
Well, I think this is absolutely critical. And I think today, even more so, when I talked to some of the law firms and I spoke to the whole audience at No Partners Conference last year about this, the importance of being a business leader first, who happens to be trained in the law, and therefore you're in this unique position to understand business first and then apply the law both to understand opportunities and risk for the business. And you will put yourself in the, you know, most valuable of strategic leaders, partners. For there are many lawyers out there who who succeed at that and actually could become CEOs themselves or run companies. Many of them don't want to do it, which is a different point. But they can be phenomenal partners, obviously, to the people leading those businesses. I encourage all of my team to think in that way. I always have done for a long time, because I think it really unlocks the full potential of what it means to be a creative, highly capable lawyer, a strategic partner, if you like, just happens to advise on the area of the law in some other way that you would have a strategic advisor, you know, management consultants and otherwise advising a business. It just happens to be. And it does put you lawyers in a unique position, because then you start to be able to look forward and horizon scan and imagine the developments that might be coming down the track, both to shape them, but also to try and influence where the business goes next, its strategic plans, how it can avoid, you know, issues and problems, but also how it can create opportunity, commercial opportunity. And that's enormously valuable. And most lawyers thrive on that. Once mm-hmm. they stand, the power that unlocks, I think they want to be at the table. They want to be a key part of that discussion and shaping and influencing and helping unlock opportunity for businesses.
Mm-hmm. And have you got any practical tips as to how to become more business focused in your
own? MBA. You don't have to do an MBA to do it, but you need to understand financials. You need to understand the commercial side. Imagine you're the CEO and sit there and say, do I instinctively understand the business plans, strategic plans? Can I pick holes in them a little bit? And then how do I help make sure that I've underpinned all of that with sound, what the legal implications of all of it are, mm-hmm. and help bring solutions? If there's a problem, bring a solution to the table. Maybe even before the CEO or spotted it, you know, mm-hmm. nothing could be more valuable. That's really what they're looking for, to look around the corners, look over the horizon and help shape things. And that's the best way to do it. You won't do that if you're just focusing on interpreting the law. Mm-hmm. And actually, well, job's going to be redundant as well, if that's what you do, coming on to the AI point, because yeah. the machine can do that. What it will not be able to do, it can... Laws based on language and information, that's what it is. And for many years already, all sorts of search tools have been used by LexisNexis and the large, you know, practical law and so forth. All that's happening now is it's just getting replaced by these large language models that are going to be able to regurgitate and refine and interpret laws at sort of the speed of light, leading to huge productivity gains. But it also means the shape of the lawyer's role is going to change, and it's going to become even more important that you can be that sort of advisor who's not knitting everything together, because the one thing the machines are not good at is multi-dimensional thinking, mm-hmm. you know, lots of complex inputs. So at least for not for a long time, I suspect they're going to have that level of intelligence. And so the lawyers sitting at the top are going to blend all of that judgment together, the tacit knowledge, and then apply that to the complexity of a complex situation. The lawyer's job is always going to be valuable for as long as it's operating in that sort of more creative strategic advisory sphere than just sort of churning out a piece of legal advice.
Yeah. Which should make it for a more interesting role.
Make it for much more interesting. Of course, you're going to need a whole bunch of people in law firms who can supervise the machines and the algorithms and so forth. But there are lots of them are working on it already, as you know. That does mean for a different skill set, what lawyers are going to have to be trained on understanding, you know, that there'll be data scientists and not even necessarily coders, but people who can certainly understand the inputs and outputs of the machines and quality assure what's being written. Because as you know, they just harvest information that's already out there, and some of it's inaccurate. So there's going to have to be a lot of quality control and assurance around it. But fundamentally, I think it's going to change the shift of capabilities in large law firms to be more than just lawyers.
Yeah.
You know, having a legal qualification or being practiced in the law is not going to be enough. You're going to have a greater commercial acumen and, you know, some form of what reasonable form of understanding, I think, about the way that the models operate and algorithms operate and so forth. But it's a really interesting time.
Yeah.
And that's the same is true with that. Lots of other professions, including accountancy, you know, across the whole scheme of professions. I was reading an article last night in The New Scientist on all of this, and all the different areas that are going to be transformed, at least anything that can be processed is going to get transformed. But that should mean that we get higher quality work in all different professions.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so then let's move on to, what three pieces of advice do you think you would give to your younger self looking back now? What do you think you'd say?
So number one, I would tell myself, don't worry about the fact that you've gone down this non-linear path and you seem to be doing something that appears at the time quite random. and unrelated because it's all unbelievably valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Taught me some basic things like people skills at a very early stage. And it was unright being able to work on a small trading floor and seeing the trade inputs and the credit risk function and the traders. And it at the time, I just felt like, you know, I've gone off on a bit of a tangent here and it's not really relevant. But later on, I realized just how relevant it was to my learning. So that would be less advice number one is just get out there and get some experience in something you enjoy doing, even if it doesn't look directly relevant to your becoming qualified lawyer. Just find something you're interested in. It might be a field or an area of industry. You could work in there for a while because that's just incredibly valuable to teach you about how that industry operates, because ultimately to be a really effective advisor, you have to understand, you know, the nuts and bolts of the industry. So that would be advice number one.
Mm-hmm.
Advice number two, don't be afraid of coaching. Just think about the key stages in your life, in your career. Expect to feel uncomfortable every time you stretch. Something new, you know, it's part of growth. It's part of your own personal growth. And like any personal growth, there will be times when it feels difficult, when it feels uncomfortable by definition, because otherwise you're not stretching yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's just how you should feel. And it's difficult because obviously you need to get that right. You don't want to do it so frequently that you're feeling continuously uncomfortable, but you should certainly feel uncomfortable for the first 6 to 12 months of any new venture where you're really stretching yourself. But then make sure that you, back to the coaching point, that you equip yourself also with some support tools to help you grow through that phase, if you like, of personal growth. And then the third one is really, this is actually really quite simple, but it's just find the thing you really enjoy doing most. That's the single most important thing, because, and you know, I know what drives me is curiosity and like just feeling like I'm learning something new all the time. Also working in a really good high values organization where everybody's, you know, works in the same kind of value system, but just work out what's important to you. And then that thing that you enjoy, because life is long and, you know, you don't want to sort of be stuck doing something that makes you miserable.
That's
obvious.
Yeah, it's interesting because you say life is long. What normally everyone tells you is life is short, but you're right. Careers are long. They're long.
Very long.
It's great. They're not so linear nowadays because
no. I mean, I've been working for nearly a year out the other day, almost 30 years now, which is really scary because it feels like it's really fast. But but actually objectively viewed, I've probably got another 20 years to go, maybe not a full-time exec career, but certainly maybe a non-exec opportunities and so forth. And there'll be a whole bunch of learning that you take into that as well, into that next phase, if you like, of your working life, because we all need to be stimulated and get up in the morning and have purpose, don't we? And find something we're enjoying doing. And I guess that's the most important thing, isn't it?
Yeah. And learning, I think I was listening to a podcast yesterday where they were talking about purpose and, you know, people who just feel like they've lost their mojo. And one of the things they're saying is if you learn something, it just brings you back on track. And it doesn't have to be something complicated. It could be a language. It could be the piano. It could be something really, you know, how to do a computer game. Something really simple. Yeah.
Yeah. I started learning the piano again a couple of years ago, having learned it as a child and then stopped it because I was being forced to do it by my mother. And then I didn't enjoy it. But I went back to it and I just... exactly that finding the time to practice, of course, is a separate point, but it's incredibly fulfilling to do something new. And you're never too old to learn something new.
Yeah.
So it's right, but it's absolutely true, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Good. Well, look, thank you so much for your time, Stephanie. That's been an amazingly stimulating conversation, as I completely expected. Yeah. And it's been lovely to speak to you. Thank you.
Good to speak to you too. Thanks.
Thanks.
That's all for this episode of the Women's Room Legal Division podcast. If you liked this episode, do subscribe to the show and follow the Women's Room Legal Division on the links in the show notes. If you are, or if you know an amazing woman in law who you think should be on this podcast, or if there are any specific coaching topics you'd like me to cover in my standalone sessions, please do get in touch using the contact me link in the show notes. Thanks so much for listening.